Hello and welcome to ID the Future. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Seattle, Washington with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. We have on the show today with us again a special guest, Dr. Stephen Webb, who graduated from Wabash College in 1983 and earned his PhD at the University of Chicago and then taught at Wabash College as professor of religion and philosophy from 1988 to 2012. He's currently on leave from Wabash College after leaving last academic year in order to retire early and pursue some writing opportunities full-time. And Dr. Webb, we're very grateful to be able to have you come and share your expertise as a theologian on ID the Future today.
It's a pleasure, Casey. Thanks for having me on.
We had a lot of fun with Dr. Webb in a previous podcast where he talked about some of the misguided critiques we've heard recently from some theistic evolutionists who have claimed that ID somehow promotes occasionalism. But we wanted to have Dr. Webb back on the show today with us to talk about his own personal story, because I think it's an interesting story. And Dr. Webb, you certainly have been engaged with this issue for a number of years as a professor at Wabash College. And I'd like for you to maybe talk to us a little bit about first, what got you interested in this issue of evolution, of origins, of intelligent design, and maybe tell us a little bit about your own personal journey on this issue.
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Beginning with this issue was reading some philosophy of science. I'd long been interested in philosophy of science, and I read some books that were critical of evolution, coming from philosophers like Mary Midgley and David Berlinski, and also books that were supportive, Ernest Mayr and people like that. But what really got me thinking about evolution was a couple of things. First of all, was the defensiveness of its supporters. I mean, it seemed to me that there was so much passion and fire there and anger that any position that was not transparent and that chose to go on the attack whenever it was criticized, raised a lot of red flags with me. But then also reading the theologians who defended evolution, I mean, so many of them come across as complete, for lack of a better word, lackeys to Darwinism. And not only just their attitude and posture, but their absolute inability to take other positions seriously and to think critically about what they're saying and to even describe the alternatives to their own viewpoint. But also the way in which these kinds of theologians obviously see themselves in service to a kind of scientific consensus. And if there's one thing that I've learned over the years is that you don't always trust any kind of consensus, especially when it's coming from higher education. The academy produces lots of great ideas, but we've seen higher education go through all sorts of consensuses about gender, for example. The consensus when I was coming through college and graduate school was that, of course, there are absolutely no physical, biological, chemical differences between the genders whatsoever. Now that's seen as nonsense, but that was complete dogma, unquestionable, and still actually is in some quarters. And so the way in which a whole slew of theologians have sided on this issue, and it just got me thinking, and the more I started thinking about it, the more I realized that questions of design, questions of inference, questions of the limit of science, questions of the metaphysical grounding of scientific claims, the question of Darwin's own interesting history in terms of his relationship to various religious beliefs that informed his views of causation and natural selection, all these things seemed just really exciting to me. So I started reading about them and started reading more from the intelligence design community, and I certainly enjoyed so much of that. It became kind of easy to pick on Darwinian fundamentalism, as I call it, because especially in the humanities, the Darwinian overreach is just amazing. The number of Darwinians that try to explain everything from not only just the human mind, human freedom and morality and religion. In fact, I taught a course on Darwinian explanations of religion, and some of these books are just laughable. And of course, you know, a lot of Darwinians will say, well, but that doesn't say anything about Darwinism. That's just Darwinian overreach. But the more I looked at the Darwinian theory and all of its contemporary manifestations and developments, the more I saw that it was an inherently voracious and ambitious and wide-sweeping set of claims. And so I taught a course for several years at my alma mater, where I was a professor, full professor of religion and philosophy, on creation and evolution. I know I'm going on and on here, Casey, but I'll just tell you one story about my experiences that kind of cemented my intuitions about what's really going on in debates about Darwinism. I taught this course for the first time, and immediately there was all sorts of nervousness among my colleagues, and I would hear things and quite suspicious and mean-spirited things about my course. I had not even shown anyone the syllabus to this course. I was never asked to show it to anyone, and no one came to me indirectly, but I soon heard that the entire science division had a motion before it and voted to censor me and my course. The vote lost by 2 or 3 votes, but now I was told by a friend of mine in the sciences that the main reason they didn't vote to censor me was they thought that that might just empower me and give me something to complain about. So they chose not to publicly censor me, but the chair of the science division at that time came to my department chair and asked her to prevent me from ever teaching this course again. And it was really an amazing intervention into my academic freedom. I mean, I was teaching books in philosophy and theology, as well as some philosophy of evolution that came from a very orthodox Darwinian perspective. And I was not overly interjecting my viewpoints into the course, and it was a popular course. And I taught courses on all sorts of things, small to large college. And my department chair came to me and told me about this. She did nothing to interfere with my academic freedom. She thought the request was bizarre because in our department, we always honored whatever research interests, wherever they were taking us and whatever we wanted to teach, as long as we covered the basic requirements for a major and minor course. But in my complaints about this just got me nowhere. It was probably the most egregious example, perhaps in the history of the college, of one set of professors trying to interfere and prevent another professor from teaching something that was clearly within his range of specialty and within the range of the departmental needs and topical courses that the department has always taught.
And the only reason they didn't stop you is because they knew it was one of those times when they knew where if they ban the book, then more people are going to read the book, right? It wasn't because they actually believed in your academic freedom. It was because they feared that by censoring you, it might actually increase the volume of your microphone and your ability to discuss your views, which is what the last thing that they wanted.
That's right. And I never received an apology. The dean never supported me on this. A word was never raised. The fact that there was actually an official vote to try to censor me and an intervention by the scientific community to try to get my own department chair to eliminate my course. Yeah, the only thing that held them back was a fear of controversy.
So this course, you said it discussed, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it discussed evolutionary explanations for the origin of religion. Is that right?
That's right. The course morphed a little bit. The first time I taught it, it was on evolutionary psychology. And I got no criticisms about that because evolutionary theories of mind, evolutionary theories of the origins of religion is a very complex and speculative and controversial field. But the next year, I used books and articles that included intelligent design essays by Meyer and Behe and Dembski and others. But then I also did some just straight-ahead philosophy of evolution. And also then some articles about, for example, the Scopes trial stuff, and also then some books on theology. And I used a book from a theistic evolutionist perspective, which laid out the idea that Christians can accept evolution completely and shouldn't criticize it in any way. I used a book that tried to be very persuasive and informed in making that case. And so I used a whole variety of books, and I should say that in a small private liberal arts college, I mean, this is a private school, there's never any question about what anyone teaches. I mean, people teach all sorts of courses that follow their own interests and that are controversial. I mean, the number of courses on gender or this or that kind of liberal motif or that radical topic. It's a very open place, but this course was perceived as quite threatening. And I remember a biologist who wanted to visit my course, and I let him. I turned the course over to him for a day, but it was just amazing. The thing he kept saying, and he's a Christian biologist, and the thing he just kept saying over and over is, science is about how things happen, religion is about why, and the two don't overlap. And so this biologist thought that what he was saying was incredibly profound and insightful. It was something he thought that I'd never thought of. And he thought that this idea of just drawing a hard line, a wall, a big barrier between science and religion, giving them each their own field. Science takes up any kind of objective meaning having to do with nature, and religion is all about extra natural or supernatural or subjective inner states and beliefs. He thought this was just obvious and simple way of solving the problem, and therefore there was nothing to discuss. And that level of naivete, that wisdom, just really amazed me. So the whole experience only, of course, drove me to think more deeply and more clearly about this. I ended up writing a book about evolution and theology called The Dome of Eden, which came out about 2 years ago. And in my field, theology, arguments in support of not only intelligent design, but in support of the very quasi-literalist, fairly common sense reading of Genesis are not very welcome. So this book kind of disappeared. In fact, I had friends tell me that they wouldn't review it for journals because they would either, they have to make a choice. Either they would say something nice about it, which would hurt their careers, or they would have to lambast it, which would hurt their friendship with me. So
they were being nice by not reviewing your book.
So this was my own particular sojourn into this sorry state of affairs.
That's a really incredible story, Dr. Webb. I mean, I want to go back to what you were saying about how your class at Wabash discussed the evolution of religion. And that interests me because I'm in my office at my house right now. I'm looking at my bookshelf. I've got about two shelves full of books written on the evolutionary origins of religion. And the vast majority of these books were written in the last 5, maybe 7 years. So this is actually a relatively new sort of burgeoning field. You might call it a little cottage industry of evolutionary theorists who are coming up with all these highly speculative explanations for how religion might provide an adaptation. And they've got all these different ideas. If there's ever an evolutionary field where there is no consensus or there's not yet any sort of consensus view, I would say it's in the evolution of religion. There's a million different ideas out there. They're almost all post hoc, after the fact, rationalizations trying to say, oh, well, maybe this could give a benefit. People work together, cooperating in groups, and religion helps you do that, and that helps you survive, and that helps explain how religion evolved. It's almost like watching some comedy sketch where you can predict all the punchlines. These books all say about the same thing, more or less. But I mean, if there's ever a field where it's out there on the fringes of speculation and there's no consensus among the scholars, it's this one. So I would think that if ever somebody with some expertise in these areas should have academic freedom to critique a field, it's in the evolution of religion. And yet you did not have that academic freedom at a liberal arts college where you're a scholar of religion. I mean, who else should have academic freedom to do this sort of thing? It's really quite disturbing to hear you tell these kinds of stories.
Yeah, it is. It certainly is. And I'm sure my story, I know my story is not unique or even all that. Similar things have been going on at Ball State, a public university here in Indiana. And, you know, the whole evolutionary theory or interpretation of religion is interesting because it shows that Darwinians can give it out, but they can't take it in. They can critique religion, which suggests that their theory has implications about religion. And yet, if you show a Darwinian that those implications are wrong, show the Darwinian theory of religion is absurd and wrong and inaccurate, historically implausible, and so on, they'll often say, well, you're not a Darwinian, you know, you're not a scientist. And what are you doing as a religious studies professor or a theologian? What are you doing criticizing a scientific theory? So it's really a lack of symmetry, a lack of mutuality. I mean, either Darwinism has something to say about religion or it doesn't. And if it does, then that's a debate where religionists, scholars of religion especially, have expertise to bring to bear. The Darwinian theories of religion are actually probably even a little bit more absurd than you might suspect, or your listeners anyway. I mean, a lot of them have to do with the theory of mind, the idea that early humans developed a kind of fear of the unknown. And in order to deal with the unknown, say you're an early hunter and you hear some rustling in the bushes, in order to deal with that unknown, you project agency on. And so even though you might be wrong, you might just be the wind rustling in the bushes, you're wise to think it might be a lion, right? Or some other person. And so we get into this neural groove of projecting causal agency onto nature. And that, for many evolutionary theorists, actually is the origin of the belief. And so the point is, they think that built into humanity in a very early stage of our evolution was this tendency to project causal agency onto nature, this habit, if you will, of thinking that something is out there, whether it is or is not, whether a lion is stalking you or not. We tend to think that the unknown source of the noise is around us, must be an agent of some sort. And so this becomes somehow mysteriously part of our chemical makeup and gets passed on to our descendants, and then develops from this very rudimentary suspicion about lions rustling in the bushes to a full-blown theology of God. the assumption there is even a belief in an eternal deity who loves us and created us and suffered on our behalf. Somehow all the mystery of that is all locked into this original primal scenario.
I think that they skipped a couple steps there. You know, we're able to detect lion rustling in the bushes. Therefore, we're going to believe in an all-powerful deity that gives up his life for us. I mean, somehow there's a bit of a disconnect.
Right.
It's amazing because if you had that biologist that came to your class and sort of his one mantra, what he thinks is going to convince religious people to accept evolution, is if he just repeats the mantra over and over again that science studies the natural world, religion studies the spiritual realm, and they never intersect and so forth. Well, if there was ever a field where it's clear that evolutionary science can tread upon the quote-unquote territory that's supposed to belong only to religion, it's in these evolutionary explanations of religion, because no longer is religion some special aspect of the human experience that was given to humanity by God. We don't have the tendency to believe in God because God wants us to detect him. We have these beliefs because they evolved through unguided natural selection and random mutation over millions of years. It has nothing to do with God giving us some special desire to seek him. It's because of evolutionary mechanisms. So if there was ever a time when science treads upon the domain of religion, it's when science tries to explain the origin of religion, not as something given to us by God, but strictly as some evolutionary adaptation, or sometimes, as Daniel Dennett calls it, a misfire of neural modules in our brain. You know, he actually sees religion as sort of an aberration of the way our minds are supposed to work. And of course, for him, atheism is when a mind is functioning normally. So it's amazing the doublespeak that we see from these evolutionary scientists who, on the one hand, will tell us that evolution, religion, totally separate realms, and then on the other hand, go out into their conferences and try to explain the origin of religion in evolutionary terms. There was a guy named Matt Rossano, who's an evolutionary psychologist, who was writing on the BioLogos website a couple years ago saying, oh, evolution and religion are totally separate realms. And then you go and you read his book, and his book is trying to explain religion as an adaptation. And he says, as our understanding of and to some degree control over the natural world increased, the need to appeal to supernatural forces was reduced or eliminated. So clearly, science is treading upon religion, but then he's telling people this talking point on the BioLogos website that evolution is not the universal God-dissolving acid that a lot fear that it is. Okay, well, which is it? I mean, it's just the doublespeak you get from these people is just mind-boggling some kind.
That's right. Not only, it's actually worse than that. It's not just a double standard. It's basically dishonest. And it's a very deceptive practices, but there's an obvious reason for it. In public, in certain situations, they'll say that, of course, it's just a theory. It's just a science. Don't worry about it. It won't challenge religious beliefs, because if then, in their books and in college level especially, they will say that it does explain religious belief. But, you know, if they told the American public that Darwinism is a theory of biological change, but also cultural change, also the origins of religion, then you would actually get a lot more worry about it being taught in schools, wouldn't you? You'd get a lot more public scrutiny of it. So they play this dishonest game. I mean, they're able to say one thing to one audience and then turn around and say another thing to another audience. And you catch them out on it, and they never admit it. They just continue to use rhetoric to cover their trail. Here's a simple logical argument. Many Darwinians believe that if Darwinism is true, then it explains everything. But if it doesn't explain everything, then that also means that it's not true. And so these arguments are actually very, very important, even on the level of theology. Intelligence design takes these arguments right into the heart of biology. They're also seriously important in terms of theology and religious studies. I mean, what are the limits to the explanatory power of Darwinism? And the limits are very obvious. But if you believe fundamentally that Darwinism explains everything, then you're going to believe just any kind of fanciful, mythical, silly folktale, because you think that there must be a Darwinian explanation for religion, or for laughter, or for the mind, or for human freedom, or for the cell membrane. And so you are going to fall for any kind of story. You're going to desperately put together any kind of story, and you will take it seriously because of your presupposition. And here's where we get back to philosophical assumptions or presuppositions that you carry, that any scholar carries with his work. And so if you believe that Darwinism must have the only explanation for a set of events or phenomena, whatever it is, then you're going to be credulous. You know, you're going to be willing to believe just about anything. And that's kind of the situation here.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I like to say that we live in interesting times. On the one hand, we're constantly assured that science and religion don't conflict. And then at the same time, we're often told by the same people that religion hinders science or that somehow science is explaining away religious beliefs. And so I feel like materialists or evolutionists, they want to project a religion-friendly image because the popular culture needs that in order to sort of accept an evolutionary viewpoint, while at the same time they want to have freedom to be able to go out and make arguments that they hope will ultimately erode religious beliefs or religious explanations. And it's a tricky balancing act, but right, it's what they have to do in order to advance their worldview and not have the public having a problem with that. It requires a lot of sort of hiding the ball. Anyway, Dr. Webb, it's been a fun conversation, and I really appreciate your persevering through some of the persecution that you have experienced, and also your time today sharing your insights with us.
You're most welcome, Casey. It's a pleasure. It really is.
Well, I'm Casey Luskin with ID of the Future. I hope this is not the last time we have Dr. Stephen Webb on the podcast with us, but stay tuned for more. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.